into the chocolate. Stir in the coffee. Gently fold in 1/3 of the whites, and then fold in the rest. 4. Pour the soufflé mixture into 4 molds, cover with plastic wrap, and refrigerate for 4 hours before serving. Though most Americans approach raw eggs with more trepidation than is perhaps necessary, it is best not to serve dishes incorporating uncooked eggs to pregnant women, small children, seniors, and people with immune system deficiencies. And organic eggs from free-range chickens are always the safest. Tastiest, too. Mousse au chocolat. Serve 6. 1/2 cup per person. There are at least a dozen chocolate mousse recipes in my family. Most French families have multiple preparations for this dessert, which is the preeminent standard and choice for homemade chocolate desserts. All of them are good, but this one is a favorite for its purity. No butter, no coffee, very little sugar, and more egg whites than yolks, which makes for an airy mousse, the perfect dessert after a rich meal. Ingredients: 4 ounces dark chocolate, 80% cacao preferred, 1 tablespoon sugar, 3 egg yolks, 5 egg whites. 1. Melt the chocolate in the top of a double boiler, set over a pan of simmering water on medium heat. 2. Remove the chocolate from the heat and add the sugar. Stir well and add the egg yolks, 1 at a time. 3. Beat the egg whites until stiff, glossy peaks are formed. Gently fold the whites into the chocolate mixture until well blended. 4. Pour the mousse into a serving bowl, cover with plastic wrap, and refrigerate overnight. Tartine au cacao. Serves 1. This kid's food works as a dessert, snack, or dinner. Following a full and balanced lunch, our nanny loved those evenings when she could feed us this easy tartine and leave once we were done. Her only complaint was that she always had to wipe my face, barbouillé de cacao, smeared with chocolate, and she had to clean me up before joining her boyfriend, who was waiting for her outside. The kid in me continues to splurge occasionally on this evening tartine. Ingredients: 1 ounce crème fraîche. Sour cream is a close approximation, and good quality cream cheese works too. 1 thick slice of country bread. Sourdough is good too. 1 tablespoon cocoa powder. 1. Spread a thick layer of crème fraîche on the bread and dust with the cocoa powder. 2. Serve with 1/2 cup of homemade hot chocolate. Finally, a little pool of melted chocolate is an irresistible setting for a piece of poached fruit and can bump a simple dessert up one level in luxury. Le pain quotidien. I was recently seated next to a famous New York restaurateur who said to me, "Isn't it terrible that no one in New York eats bread anymore?" Since the carb police have been patrolling 24 hours a day, bread seems to have become public enemy number one. To me, it's just sad that so many people are foregoing one of life's most elemental pleasures for the sake of a dead-end weight loss strategy. It's sadder still that the adherents of the strategy would rather risk heart disease than let a bit of bread pass their lips. Does bread make people fat? Ridiculous. Too much of most things will make you fat, of course. But there's nothing wrong with bread, per se. Eliminating it from one's diet is lamentable, probably unhealthy, and very un-French. The French say, "On ne badine pas avec l'amour." You don't fool around with love. To us, the same goes for bread, an old flame we will never part with. Don't get me wrong. I don't insist bread has to be in your life. Hundreds of millions of people on this planet get on fine without it. But if you appreciate good bread, as I do, be advised that you can enjoy it while still managing a healthy weight. Good bread is rich in fiber and vital for le transit intestinal, and we French care about our digestion as much as our alimentation. And since French bread contains no fat and tends toward lightness, it's not the sort of calorie pack you need to approach all that cautiously. But French women do have their ground rules about it. We count our slices, and do not eat bread before our first course is served, avoiding a great pitfall of dining out, the bread pre-appetizer. It's a simple trick worth learning. Unless you are faint from hunger, you can hold out for 10 minutes and save a good number of calories and room for your balanced meal. A slice or two of bread with a meal, or as a meal, is one of our great pleasures. One slice, about an inch thick if it's the silver dollar baguette diameter, has no more calories than a piece of fruit, and, being a starch, releases sugar more slowly. With a little something extra, a couple of sardines, a slice of truffle, what have you, and some butter, it can be a wonderfully satisfying, balanced little meal unto itself. Tartine beurrée, bread and butter, is great for breakfast. Jambon beurre, ham on a buttered baguette, the classic French sandwich, makes a popular lunch. In American sandwiches, the bread seems incidental. In French sandwiches, it's the filling that offers the occasion to eat bread. Not that you need an occasion. My mother would regularly break off a piece of baguette at around 11 a.m. and eat it as a coupe-faim. The biggest obstacle for Americans is not the amount of bread they consume, but the quality. In this respect, alas, they are not alone. Most European countries have lost the traditional knack for good bread. Even in Italy, where food reaches heights to rival those in France and is an equally serious affair, the quality of bread is not what it was. Italian friends who visit me in Paris are always in search of the best baguette and the best pain au levain or croissant. These last are subject to annual contests where I come from, which keeps France's great bakers on their toes. They have to be, because the French simply do not tolerate bad bread. I have seen Parisian friends complain about the bread to the owners of a little neighborhood bistro with otherwise delicious food. Granted, it was not the best bread I ever had, but it was hardly the inedible, industrial kind one might get in a somewhat comparable New York restaurant. No matter. By the next visit, I noticed they had changed bakers. Can you imagine that in any other country? We share a set of standards and expectations. The baguette has to be croustillante, crispy and crusty, with large, irregular air holes, while we look for moyeu, softness and unctuousness, and acidity in the white of the pain au levain. And there are food assignments. With oysters, we like pain de seigle, a light brown bread that's 2/3 rye and 1/3 wheat flour. With our cheese, we love walnut or hazelnut bread, not just any nut bread. And of course, olive bread has become a staple not just in Provence, but as an accompaniment to Mediterranean fare anywhere, particularly fish preparations. Still, bread is never reduced to the ordinary. And as with other things, we take pleasure in exploring all its sensual possibilities. I would be misleading you, however, if I left the impression that France has been a paradise of bread during my whole life. In fact, from the 1960s through the 1980s, we endured a sort of national bread crisis, what we French ironically call the industrial ersatz period, when time-honored methods and tools were replaced by industrial equipment and techniques. It was a Gaullist idea of progress, I suppose. Fortunately, that is mostly behind us, though remnants of that age can still be found in plastic bags in the hypermarché. Thanks to an American named Stephen Kaplan, a professor at Cornell University, as well as a Francophile and bread lover, and to the former Prime Minister Edouard Balladur, reform legislation was passed in 1993. The now famous Balladur Law has immensely improved, or rather reclaimed, the traditional standards for French bread, regulating flour quality, yeast content, fermentation techniques, and taste. It has made certain that no French bread lover will ever again be left behind. Today, tradition is safely entrusted to a new generation of devoted artisanal bakers. They take pride not only in getting it right, but in making it better. recognizing that the reputation of the nation is at stake. To my great satisfaction, these new bakers have their spiritual confrères in America. The bread renaissance is a vital part of the American artisanal movement, and there has been a proliferation of specialty shops and new offerings in the farmers' markets, as I find at my favorite haunt, New York's Union Square. But if you don't live near a devoted artisan, and it's hit or miss outside major cities, what's an American woman to do without access to great bread? When I first moved to New York, I was in that very boat. It forced me to do something few French women ever need to do, learn to bake my own. What was even tougher, I had to learn to make croissants to answer a hard-wired Sunday morning craving that simply would not respond to Sara Lee or the greasy abominations chain bakeries call croissant. For those who may consider baking bread as much a backward waste of time as taking your laundry down to the river, I offer the wisdom of the great American gastronome M.F.K. Fisher, who, in The Art of Eating, wrote, "No yoga exercise, no meditation in a chapel filled with music will rid you of your blues better than the humble task of making your own bread." It's not that I can rival the bakers of Paris in quality, but nothing prepares one for the full experience of tasting great bread like the aromatic anticipation of baking it. And nothing equals the taste of bread in that first half hour out of the oven. Perhaps it's why, in Paris, I time my weekends around the baking schedule of Carton, the great master in my neighborhood. Perhaps, too, it's why in New York, friends continue coming over on Sunday morning for my amateur croissant long after professional standards have improved. It's a willingness to reap the pleasures of food at its most elementally wonderful. French women don't eat Wonder Bread. Try baking bread some weekend. Baguettes makes four. These 18 to 24-inch wands of French bread are as much a symbol of France as the Eiffel Tower. And while French women don't bake them today when they are for sale on almost every commercial block of every town and city, there's no substitute for the intoxicating aromas of freshly baked bread at home. Good baguettes should be crusty, moist, slightly chewy, and, of course, flavorful. And they are amazingly easy to make. The water content depends on the flour and the weather. Ingredients: 1 teaspoon active dry yeast, 2 cups warm water, 4 to 5 cups unbleached all-purpose white flour, 2 teaspoons kosher salt, 1 egg beaten and mixed with 1 tablespoon cold water. 1. In a small bowl, dissolve yeast in 1/2 cup warm water. Stir with a fork. Set aside for 10 minutes. 2. Combine the flour and salt. Add the yeast mixture and stir in the remaining 1.5 cups water. Mix the dough until it is sticky enough to knead. On a lightly floured board, knead for 6 to 10 minutes. The dough should be sticky and smooth. Put the dough in a bowl, cover with a damp tea towel, and let rise at room temperature until doubled in volume, about 1 hour. 3. Punch down the dough and divide into 4 pieces. Roll each into a ball and shape into a baguette. Transfer the loaves to a lightly greased baking sheet. I use a special baguette-shaped baking pan and let rise until nearly doubled. 4. Preheat the oven to 450 degrees. Brush the baguettes with the egg water mixture. Score the loaves diagonally across the top with a sharp knife. 5. Pour 2 cups of hot water into a pan and place in the preheated oven next to the baguettes to provide moisture. Bake the baguettes for 15 minutes and then lower the temperature to 400 degrees and bake for 5 to 10 minutes more until golden brown. Remove from the oven and cool on a rack before slicing. Croissant makes 12. Croissants are created in stages. It takes time to grow them. You will need to start on Friday to enjoy your Sunday AM epiphany. But the individual steps are rather quick, and in all take only about 1.5 hours. And the technique is not difficult to master. After a few times, you'll be an expert croissant baker. Ingredients: 1 cup milk plus 2 tablespoons to brush over croissant, 2 teaspoons active dry yeast, 2¼ cups plus 3 tablespoons sifted all-purpose flour. Measure and reserve in separate bowls. 2 tablespoons sugar, 1 teaspoon salt, 12 tablespoons sweet, unsalted, butter. For glaze, 1 egg yolk mixed with 1 tablespoon milk. Friday evening, day 1. 1. Heat 1 cup of the milk to lukewarm. Dissolve the yeast in 1/4 cup of the lukewarm milk. Stir in 2 tablespoons flour from the 2¼ cups and whisk until there are no lumps. Cover with plastic wrap and let stand at room temperature until doubled in volume. This will take about 20 minutes. 2. Mix the sugar and salt into the 2¼ cups flour. 3. Heat the remaining milk. Transfer the raised dough to the bowl of an electric mixer fitted with the dough hook. Add the lukewarm milk, and with the mixer at high speed, start adding the sugar, salt, and flour from step 2, a little at a time, reducing the speed to low-medium until the dough is sticky and soft. 4. Cover the bowl with plastic wrap and refrigerate overnight. Saturday morning, day 2. 1. Bring the butter to room temperature and work it with the heel of your hand to incorporate the remaining 3 tablespoons of flour until smooth. Shape into a square. 2. Sprinkle the work surface, a marble slab is ideal, with the flour. Shape the cold dough into a 6x15-inch rectangle and spread the butter square on the upper 2/3 of the rectangle, leaving a 1/2-inch border around the sides and top. Fold the dough like a letter into thirds. Turn the dough counterclockwise. It will look like a notebook with the open flap on your right. And then again, roll out the dough into a 6x15-inch rectangle and fold as before. 3. Transfer the dough to a baking pan, cover with plastic wrap, and refrigerate for 6 hours. Saturday afternoon, day 2. Roll out the dough 2 more times, wrap, and refrigerate overnight. Sunday morning, day 3. 1. About 1.5 hours before baking time, remove the dough from the refrigerator and sprinkle flour on the work surface. Roll the dough into a 16-inch circle, working as quickly as possible. Using a knife, cut the dough into quarters, and then cut each quarter into 3 triangles. 2. With both hands, roll the base of each triangle toward the remaining corner. Do not curl the ends in a croissant shape. Transfer the croissant to a baking sheet and brush with 2 tablespoons milk. Let stand at room temperature for about 45 minutes or until the croissants have doubled in volume. 3. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Brush the croissant with the glaze and bake for 15 to 20 minutes. If the croissants brown too fast, cover them loosely with foil and continue baking. Let cool 20 minutes before serving. Poppy seed rolls. Makes 12. Amazingly, neither my mother nor my Tanta Berta ever used a recipe or a cookbook, and although this recipe, adapted from what I remembered watching, is good, I confess I have never tasted the equal of Tanta Berta's delicious rolls. Replacing poppy seeds with cumin yields 1 more recipe variation from Alsace. Ingredients: 1 egg, 1 tablespoon water, 1¼ cups plain yogurt. You can use the previous recipe, or if you buy it, make sure it's unsweetened and has no additives. 4 tablespoons olive oil, 2½ cups unsifted all-purpose flour, 2 tablespoons sugar, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 tablespoon double-acting baking powder, 1 teaspoon poppy seeds. 1. Mix together the egg and water. Reserve. 2. Whip the yogurt and olive oil to a smooth consistency. Sift together the flour, sugar, salt, and baking powder. Make a well and pour the yogurt oil mixture into the center. Using your fingertips, mix the dough until it is homogeneous. Work the dough until it no longer sticks and has a smooth consistency. 3. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Make 12 round rolls and put on a baking sheet. Brush with the egg water mixture and sprinkle with poppy seeds. Using a sharp knife, make a cross on top of each roll. Bake in the preheated oven for 30 minutes or until the rolls are golden. They are good warm, but you can, of course, serve them at room temperature once cooled. Bread in restaurants. Although I don't like to dine late, by American standards I often do. Usually it's 8 or 8:30 p.m. before I've been seated. In France, a true restaurant, as opposed to a bistro, brasserie, or a place that caters to tourists, won't even take a reservation before 8 p.m., and most of the French don't arrive till 9. Actually, that's nothing. In Spain and South America, they sit down at 11 p.m. Nevertheless, having started the day by 7 a.m., I'm always psychologically and physically in need of something before dinner. So it has taken some training to limit myself to a glass of champagne or water and wait till food is served. I used to find myself immediately eating a slice or two of bread, at least in restaurants. As I have mentioned, I identified pre-dining bread as a problem well after my Dr. Miracle days. Recognizing an acquired offender, they can appear at any point, was important. Cutting back was simple and produced results. Subtracting 12 or 15 unnecessary slices of bread per week will bless you with room for more conscious indulgences. 10. Moving like a French woman. The great writer Colette was the first French woman to work out in the American sense. She would rise every morning and hit the gym, a collection of primitive contraptions she even traveled with. To most French women, however, the idea holds little appeal. For while exerting oneself physically is completely essential to Montaigne's ideal of the healthy mind in a healthy body, dressing to break a sweat doesn't go with being French. Partly, it all seems such a great, joyless effort. Cutting 2 hours out of the precious day, the travel, changing, learning to use machines, waiting to use them, showering, drying your hair, and so on. And you have to pay for it, as my friend Sylvie snickers. So while you will surely find all the latest apparatus in a good French hotel, know that they are there as a grudging concession to tourists and business people. It's odd for a French woman to use them, or to be seen jogging in the Luxembourg Gardens or the Tuileries. Odd, but charming, too, because what French women do, they do out of their own desires. You see, we are all, to the core, individualistes invétérés, stubborn individualists. And as long as you are doing your own thing, it's fine. Some, though not many, French women enjoy sport. Tennis and swimming are both fun and excellent for you. Bon, if your kick is running in the park, we say amuse-toi bien. Have fun. It's only the view of the workout as mandatory sentence that rubs us the wrong way. It's the American rule of no pain, no gain that we reject. A disproportionate amount of exercise, as some American women practice, may turn out to load the deck against your weight loss goals. While offering little or no health benefit compared with milder exertion, the overheated workout may in fact lead to defeatism, I give up, even to heartier eating. Indeed, Too many women I know exercise so that they end up with oversized appetites just to refuel their bodies. They become like gym rats on a treadmill. It's obvious that someone is plotting against them. Just look at all the offender foods stocked in gym cafes, awaiting these unsuspecting women after their 2-hour session. Sugary fruit juices, half-pound muffins, high-protein bars. You can cancel out your whole routine before you're even out the door. French women know any regimen you can't maintain for long stretches of life is bound to fail you, just as they know that boredom, not food, is the enemy. American women seem to have 2 modes, sitting or spinning. French women prefer the gentler, more regular varieties of all-day movement, the slow burn, in American terms. And, as you might expect, our approach, true to Cartesian principles, demands that you use your mind as you use your body. Mindless exercise is almost as bad as mindless eating. We strive to diversify the physical movement in our lives and practice it as second nature, and we cultivate awareness as we go. French women see exertion as an integral part of the day. I encourage you to look at everyday movement, what you do in street clothes, as essential to your overall wellness, and not to see exertion as something assigned to the gym. It may mean extra steps in the yard, or not using inter-office mail. Or it may mean riding your bike to work, or ironing your own clothes. The point is to practice as much physical exertion for as many moments of the day as you can manage. This is the surest way to overcome the mental hurdle that the idea of regular exercise presents to some of us. Reap the benefits without the bother. If you believe working at your desk leaves you no time for such things, you should realize that stress and fatigue in modern life typically have more to do with a lack of exertion than with too much. À pied. Here's a story about the Swiss you may not have heard. They are the world's biggest producers and consumers of chocolate, more than 20 pounds a year per person. Yet they are not tipping the scales in the World Weight Gaining Olympics. Why? Half of their run-of-the-mill getting around is done on foot or bicycle. Americans, on average, travel on their own steam less than 10% of the time. We French claim little resemblance to the Swiss, except in the domains of chocolate and walking, where we are more than respectable performers. Every time we are in France for a week or more, my husband is astounded that we both shed a pound or two, even as we seem to eat more. The trick? We walk a lot. Walking is an essential part of the French way of life, and the average French woman walks 3 times as much as the average American. For the whole lower half of your body, there could be no better exercise. You work the legs, top to bottom, and the buttocks, particularly if your strides are long. And the cardiovascular benefits of brisk walking have been shown to be as good as those of running, but without endangering your joints. I urge you to increase your walking in 2 ways. First, add regular, dedicated walks to your day. Not death marches, just smart strolls. Start small if you like, then make your strolls a little longer each day. Whether it's walking to work all or part of the way, or for 20 minutes after dinner, good for digestion and unwinding, adding 3 hours of walking to your week is a painless and reliable way to weight loss. When you begin to see it working for you, you'll find yourself automatically walking more. Wherever I am, I begin most days with a 20-minute walk before breakfast. Second, look for ways to increase your incidental walk time. This means resisting the American impulse to save a step. We French are not as fiendish about finding shortcuts as Americans are. Perhaps it is why we are no longer a great power. But the trade-off is that we are not fat. In life, we believe the journey is the destination. If you're not that philosophical, remember it simply. Time saved equals calories not burned. Have a little walk around while waiting for someone. As we say, faire les 100 pas, literally, walk 100 steps. Contrary to popular wisdom, walking is not as simple as chewing gum. Any physical activity must be pursued thoughtfully, with an eye to balance and harmony. So, what is the best way to walk? Avoid treading congested streets and carrying heavy things. Even if you can manage that bag, its weight creates a subconscious incentive to avoid walking next time. Stilettos are not a good idea, but you don't need garish running shoes either. French women wear comfortable loafers, pumps, or rubber-soled lace-ups that are presentable anywhere. City parks and roads without traffic in the country are great places to walk. But even the air-conditioned mall will do fine if being outdoors is not bearable where you are. I know an 88-year-old woman who lives in the suburbs, and all winter long she takes a daily walk in a huge supermarket. To each her own. Of course, city or country, you'll probably come to know your walk preferences only if you pay attention. Some respond to nature, others to people watching. Discover what engages you. The most important aspects of walking are posture and breathing. It's vital to hold your head erect and keep your back straight, chin up, as though your attention is fixed on some point in the distance or on looking for a lover in a foggy train station. But watch your step, too. I know people who've found a lot of change in the street just looking down from time to time. Relax your shoulders, then arch them back. Feels like pushing out your chest, such that you can imagine a little brook running down your back between your shoulder blades, and be conscious of keeping them in that position. After a while, it becomes automatic. Bad posture in walking will announce itself with a sore neck and back. Inhale and exhale deeply and slowly. Concentrating on your breathing will improve the meditative value of your walk. As with eating, awareness heightens the overall stimulation of the experience, and stimulation equals satisfaction. Your gait is important, too. Use your arms, and don't walk on the ball of the foot only. Heel and toe is the way to go. Always carry and drink water. Before you know it, you'll be there. On weekdays during my first two student years in Paris, I used to walk between the Eiffel Tower and the Sorbonne, a different route going and coming, though avoiding pastry shops each way while that was still necessary. On the weekends, my roommate and I, both provincial girls discovering Paris with very wide eyes, would spend Saturdays walking the different arrondissements or gardens or along the banks of the Seine. Often we must have walked 6 to 8 miles, stopping only for lunch and a 5 o'clock ice cream, that little weekly reward, at the famous Bertillon on the Île Saint-Louis. In the end, we knew the city better than most Parisians. For me, walking remains the ultimate time for freedom of thought. It's when I feel my tensions liberated, and a kind of bien-être, as the promenade of the mind follows that of the body. It can be a special kind of indulgence, these moments when one becomes aware of really existing, as the images, information, and other sensations the world tries to press upon us all recede. Learning to be comfortable in that space, when it's just you, takes practice. But doing so diminishes the impulse to lie to yourself or run away. You won't want to. Going up? Let's not forget the third dimension of earthly movement. It always astounds me to see people who live no higher than the fourth floor taking the elevator. In France, walking up and down stairs is part of everyone's day. Unless you have a lot to carry, you wouldn't think of taking the elevator for a couple of flights. And often you have no choice, as in Paris, which is full of old buildings without elevators. Of course, no one climbs stairs for an hour over a normal day. But think about this. The body spends about 60 calories an hour sleeping. If you swim, you'll do better at 430 calories. But climbing stairs consumes a stunning 1,100 calories per hour. Vive l'escalier! In my third year as a student in Paris, I had the good fortune to become an apartment sitter for a painter who spent most of her time in the lovely southern town of Collioure. She offered me a room of my own, as well as free run of the rest of her huge place. I had major party visions, especially on seeing that wraparound terrace looking onto the Sorbonne and the lovely square Pain Levé, whose name means leavened bread, next to the precious Cluny Museum of Medieval Art. It was a fantasy location, where the 5th arrondissement, Latin Quarter, borders the 6th, Saint-Germain-des-Prés. There was only one catch. It was a 6th-floor walk-up. When I moved in, I had already shed the pounds I'd gained as an exchange student, but if I hadn't, my house-sitting stint would have made a big dent in the problem before long. I found myself losing weight without even meaning to, particularly during the May-June exam period, when I would go up and down all day, downstairs to study in the tiny square Pain Levé, then back upstairs for lunch or to use the bathroom or get another book I needed or my notebook for class around the corner. I managed to go up and down the 89, counting them became a private game, stairs 6 or 8 times a day. By the beginning of the summer, I was floating in my clothes, despite my daily dose of chocolate and bread and lots of restaurant meals with friends. And when I put on my bikini in July, the change in shape, courtesy of Le Grand Escalier, was a thrill. Better leg and buttock toning a trainer could not have delivered. That's when I became hooked on stairs, and now I seek them out, as religiously as most American women I know avoid them. When I moved to New York, we first lived on the 4th floor of a West Village brownstone. I'll never forget opening the door for our first dinner guests, each of them, regardless of age, totally breathless from the 3 flights. These days, we live on the 15th floor of a 15-story building, with elevator, bien sûr, so no one needs to walk up for a visit. But as my perplexed neighbors can verify, several times a week I can be seen going up and down the stairs, 125, I still count, sans problème. The blackout of August 2003 was a revealing occasion for me. I was passing exhausted 25 and 40-year-olds who'd stopped to rest on the 6th or 8th or 10th floor. Our building, I hasten to add, has a gym for its residents. Another case of the props of fitness standing in for results. It strikes me as an American paradox. A nation with so many great athletes and a fascination for sports and such a mania for exercise technology, and they somehow avoid the easy, unheroic path to fitness. Sometimes I believe all these machines are a vestige of Puritanism, instruments of public self-flagellation to make up for private sins of couch riding and overeating. French women happily don't suffer from those extremes of good and evil. Wellness is a gray area of balance. Simple as it may seem to add a few steps, it may be impractical for you, or for some reason against your doctor's advice. Always ask a physician first when it comes to exercise. In that case, there are other ways of increasing the calorie burn quotidien that should also do the trick. As with eating, it's a matter of compensation, and a good place to look is in the realm of so-called modern conveniences. Many things designed to make life easier, from remote control to no iron sheets, have really only made us more sedentary. Studies show that the Amish are much less likely to get fat than other Americans. If you stop seeing repetitive chores as drudge work and instead look at them as a meditative form of mild exertion, you will be helping the weight loss and wellness cause in a big way. Again, pick something you find rewarding. Cleaning house, believe it or not, can enhance your mood. It represents a job done, a kind of simple satisfaction in a world in which our tasks are more and more complex and our projects drag on for weeks. Don't be deceived by the American tendency to view mundane exercise as strictly for people too old or weak for extreme training. Women of all ages can benefit enormously from more routine exertion. Also remember that you can increase or decrease depending on the results you see. Being a French woman requires continual fine-tuning. Practice it, and soon you won't need to give it a second thought. easy movements and exercises. I'm not wistful for the era of day-long back-breaking work on the French farm, but I do believe that we have gone too far in developing a less physical lifestyle. Often, the time saved is spent brooding about work and family, stewing in our juices. Careful routine exertion can see you perfectly well through middle age. But as a woman gets older, there is a natural weakening of muscle and bone, and you may consider a bit of more special strength training. Colette, who worked out madly, seems to have burned out early, and in her old age she was not very fit, couldn't even walk on her own. Small free weights, 3 to 5 pounds, used in simple, familiar exercises, are a good way to preserve upper body tone and bone density and supplement the cardiovascular benefits of an active lifestyle. It's also good as we age to attend to our abdomen with a few sit-ups first thing in the morning. It's never too early to start doing so, as they are the muscles that hold all the vital organs in place, in addition to their support of good posture. You can incorporate simple resistance movements into your daily routine even before you leave the house. After your shower or bath, for instance, try to dry your toes with your towel while keeping your legs straight. While waiting in your car or in the subway, contract your abs for 12 seconds with your back pressed against the seat. Better for you than road rage. Use your own body weight as resistance wherever possible. Isometric exercises, discreet but effective, are very French. When reading a magazine at home, try sitting on the floor with your legs stretched and apart in a V and your hands on each side. This is a great stretch for your inner thigh muscles. At work, get up from your desk periodically. People are amazed to see a CEO doing her own photocopying, but it's an excuse for me to walk to the end of the hall and stretch. You get the picture. The key is to increase daily energy expenditure. Add a few moves to the regular ones all day long. Don't save your steps. Multiply them. Little changes are always easier than big ones, but they do add up. Take the long view. Burning a mere 50 extra calories a day through les petites choses, little things, equals a few pounds of fat a year. Faites simple, and you'll never cry out, "I give up." À bout de souffle, breathless. In the end, all movements depend on proper breathing, the one movement we do more than any other, 22,000 times a day. It takes some calories to move 15 kilos of air each day as we do. Breathlessness will stop you in your tracks and prevent the body's efficient burning of fuel. Moreover, steady breathing with awareness promotes a balanced, appreciative relationship to food. You may consider yourself an accomplished breather, but it's worth your while to learn how to do it better. That's what I told a group of women as I opened a 3-day business seminar in San Francisco about 10 years ago. I showed them a few techniques I learned from an instructor in Paris. I didn't care if they never tried them again. The point is that no one should go through life without being made to think at least once about the deep significance of breathing. And if you continue thinking about it, you can harness the most discreet and portable mechanism we have for reestablishing the mind-body link, which is so terribly eroded by our fast-paced lives. Conscious breathing is the easiest form of meditation and the most basic part of yoga, which I highly recommend if you have the inclination to take classes in anything. This type of breathing disconnects eating from our stress response equipment, a major cause of overeating and binging. It also enhances our overall energy by releasing energy in every cell of the body. Breathing is the driving process of metabolism. I practice breathing movements in the subway, okay, not too deeply there, on the plane, lying in bed, and sitting at my desk, but also as part of my home routine, wherever I have to breathe anyway. Part of the appeal is being in the moment. Breathing is the ultimate present moment stimulation. Think about doing it, and you don't think of the past or the future. You are in the here and now. That's the ultimate zone diet. Try these basics. Step 1. rhythm and awareness. Close your eyes. Place one hand on your belly and notice your breathing. Feel your hand rise slightly with each new breath in. Feel it fall with each breath out. Focus on this motion of rising and falling for 12 breaths. Step 2. Count down to sleep. Start with the step 1 movement until you are comfortable with the pace. As you breathe in, inwardly say 12. Then breathe out. With the next breath, say 11. Breathe out. Continue until you reach 0. Take your time. Slow is good. Repeat this for a couple of minutes, or until you fall asleep. Step 3. Slow down to sleep. Now when you breathe in, count to 6 to yourself, and when you breathe out, count to 9. While you do it, clear your mind of any thoughts and concentrate totally on your breathing. It takes only a few repetitions or deep breaths until you feel relaxed, and eventually you will fall asleep. Step 4. Wave breathing. Digestion depends on the autonomic system, which explains the influence our emotions have on our gastric function. Therefore, it is essential to breathe well in order to eat more slowly and to give the brain the necessary time to register satiety. The wave is best practiced when you are, or think you are, hungry and/or before meals. Standing, sitting, or lying flat on your back, put one hand on your belly and the other above it, mid-chest, wrist below the breasts. Breathe in and expand your chest while pushing a bit on the abdomen. Breathe out and expand your abdomen while exerting a slight pressure on the chest. Repeat 24 times. Then go back to your normal breathing before you return to whatever you were doing. Step 5. Alternate nostril breathing. A little odd, but bear with me. French is a very nasal language. Standing or sitting, breathe out through both nostrils. Next, close your right nostril with your right thumb. Breathe in on the left side. Close your left nostril with the right index finger. Both nostrils are now pinched closed. Hold breath in. Release thumb and exhale out of right nostril. Breathe in again through right nostril. Hold and again close nostril with right thumb. Release index finger and breathe out left side. This completes one set. Repeat 6 times. Count to 6 for each holding, breathing in, breathing out. Step 6. Yawning. I actually learned this one when I first moved to New York and was studying modern dance as a hobby. I was no great dancer, but I was a star at yawning and can do it on cue without any difficulty. Before that class, I never knew it relieves stress, calms you down, and even puts you to sleep if repeated, which sometimes happened at the end of the class as we lay on our backs practicing the art of yawning. While you yawn, you actually allow a greater amount of oxygen than normal into your lungs, which revitalizes blood flow. Even the sound of a good yawn helps reduce tension. To make yourself yawn, you have to breathe in deeply and stretch your mouth open as wide as possible. After 2 or 3 tries, the natural yawning response is triggered and can go on indefinitely. Dormez-vous? The question is not just for Frère Jacques. Sleep is the most neglected state of being in American life. We think we can cut corners, push ourselves to the limit. To some degree, it has even become subject to the calculus of good and evil, with virtue ascribed to making do with less. This is nonsense. Nothing else except breathing and drinking water is as immediately vital to our well-being as sleep. And there is an under-acknowledged connection between sleeping too little and gaining weight. Proust began his masterpiece with a slow and agonized wind down to Z's. He gave it a lot of thought and comment, as we French will do with most things. Now, while we don't wish to encourage such performance anxiety, sleep must be done well. There is an art to this, too. But as with other pleasures, and good sleep is one of the most basic, respect for the individual is paramount, as no two of us have the same requirements or patterns. When we lived and labored according to the sun and the seasons, getting to sleep was easier, and our internal clock, circadian rhythms, reset itself reliably as the days got longer or shorter. Now, each of us follows her own clock, often getting by with too little sleep. At the same time, there is an insomnia epidemic, with a corresponding wave of pharmaceutical remedies. We are regularly warned of the mounting national sleep debt that research has demonstrated increases insulin resistance and triggers the release of stress response hormones. It's a vicious cycle, since the body's responses to sleep deprivation can make it only harder for us to sleep. Sleeplessness also makes us listless, which encourages us to overeat, food being the most obvious other way to achieve reinvigoration. When we feel this way, we tend to lean on high-energy foods. And of course, lack of sleep interferes with the mental mechanisms by which we register pleasure. Optimal experience depends on sensory alertness. Consider a good night's sleep vital to proper eating and balance. There are rituals that can promote a good night's rest. To me, the tisane is essential, but water in any form can help, because dehydration always undermines the quality of our sleep time. For this reason, alcohol just before sleep is not good, and in small amounts is known to have the paradoxical effect of being a stimulant. We French only seem to have a monopoly on paradox. As to setting, look around your bedroom. You don't need to be a feng shui master to make improvements. Gentle lighting that promotes somnolence can help greatly. In Provence, in summer, the bloom of lavender delivers a natural sleep aid into the night air. I'm always reminded of the splendid lavender fields of the Abbaye de Senanc near Gordes in the Vaucluse. The smell is wonderfully soporific, and you can enjoy it in the freshly picked variety or by burning a bit of the plant's essential oil. Louis XIV demanded the presence of all his worthies in his bedchamber, not only for his coucher, going-to-bed ritual, but also for his lever, rising. You don't need an audience to practice routines that tell your body bedtime approaches. Try to go to bed relaxed. We French like eating late, but don't go to bed without having digested dinner. This may mean eating lightly at night, when carbohydrates are a good idea, with a glass of wine, a relaxant if used in moderation and with food. Better to have a yogurt snack just before bed to neutralize the occasional coupe de faim than to eat too late or overeat early and fall asleep on a full stomach. Controlled breathing is another way to prepare your body. The yawning exercise is useful here. Don't neglect room temperature either. Even in winter, this should be cool, 68 degrees at maximum. Except in blizzard conditions, do open your window a crack for some fresh air. It's important to catch the train when it's in the station. If you ignore sleepiness signals, you may need another 2 hours to feel sleepy again. Sleeping and rising at the same time each day is a good idea. The ritual of sleeping until noon on Sundays to catch up is based on a misconception. Food may be organized on the weekly calendar, but not sleep. Better to try napping 10 to 20 minutes during the day. Avoid the long siesta of 2 hours, as it will interfere with your sleep rhythm. Finally, remember moderation. While need can vary from one individual to another, less than 6 hours or more than 8 may be unhealthy. Though few of us sleep too much, it is possible to have too much of even this good thing. Your body will sleep less efficiently if you give it too much time au lit. Posture. A little plug for good posture. Weight is related to height, or at least our sense of it. French women learn to hold their chin high and have good posture. Just pretend you have a rope or wire attached to the center of your head, pulling you up. For some reason, only girls get the tiens-toi droite, stand up straight reminder as we grow up. I recall one at the lycée who stood so erect that we asked her what she had been doing. At home, her mother would hold a ruler across her shoulders to force her to memorize the right posture. When I was growing up, we learned to practice posture in ballet class. None of us became ballerinas, but the few classes did help. And our gym teacher always advised that as we French were a smallish race, cheating to look quelques centimètres plus grande was no crime. So when I catch myself slouching while sitting in front of the computer or walking on the street, I think about the gym teacher and correct my posture instantly. And I do feel taller. 11. States of Desire. The mind is the French woman's ultimate firewall against getting fat, and the senses are, of course, the portals to the mind. Through them, we take in the world, its flavors, its textures, its sounds, and its smells. We all practice a little form of yoga with our senses. We concentrate on them just as we concentrate on our breathing. In this way, we get the most out of experience, including what we eat. Contentment of this kind is something you make for yourself. It's the essence of l'art de vivre, the art of living, which is how we French pursue joie de vivre, the joy of living. While this pursuit sometimes causes us to be mocked as too bourgeois, in fact, our way of pursuing pleasure has little to do with social status. Our next vacation means much more to us than a new car, and we would never sacrifice the former for the latter, except in a case of dire necessity. Give us being and feeling over having any day. Anyone possessed of the five human senses can reap the benefits of sharpening them. Walking on the beach, touching a pet, eating an orange, picking up and sniffing a piece of wood, all are sensory experiences of which we can become more aware through practice. Concentrate on each, develop your own terms of description, and soon your every moment will be fuller. One must never forget that little experiences produce, through association and memory, a gamut of emotions. These are linked with our life experiences, culture, and environment. Proust's Madeleine takes countless forms. The more conscious you become of these effects, the more you can make of them, and the better you'll be at evading the effects of more destructive emotions. French women make sure they have lots of petit rien, those little nothings of daily pleasure that are actually quite something to us. We have so many words for pampering: gâter, dorloter, bichonner, se chouchouter. But we don't equate it with decadence. It makes us enjoy life more from moment to moment and keeps us from seeking too much consolation from any one pleasure, such as food. If we deny ourselves something, it's not to teach our greedy selves a lesson. Self-punishment is never our path to well-being. The only purpose of withholding some pleasure is so we can more fully enjoy everything else for having it in proper balance. Of course, there's nothing we enjoy as often or universally as food. So it's quite foreign to us the way Americans associate eating with sin and guilt. A French woman might refer to her afternoon pastry at a café terrace as her petit péché mignon, but she is being ironic. Only in the French mind could sin be tiny and adorable. The American gastronomic morality, by contrast, is dead serious. As the charming Anglo-sometime American Francophile Peter Mayle writes in French Lessons, scarcely a week goes by without some ominous pronouncement about the price we must pay for our brief moments of indulgence. The trouble, as he wisely understands, is not having a little butter and wine and red meat. The trouble is having way too much. Eating in America has become controversial behavior, with all sorts of non-nutritional, sexual, social, political, cultural, and even clinical overtones. Our troubles with weight have as much to do with our attitudes toward eating as they do with what we are ingesting. We are seeing a growing psychosis that I believe actually adds stress to our already stressful way of life. It is fast erasing the simple values of pleasure. Without a national change of heart, we have little hope of turning the tide of the obesity epidemic. The love of eating. For the French, Colette put it best when she described the table as un rendez-vous d'amour et d'amitié, a date with love and friendship. And it's not a purely figurative description, because we tend to see our pleasures as being interconnected. We can't imagine anything more boring than to live with someone who doesn't care about food or eating or sharing meals. One passion goes hand in hand with another. Of course, it's a two-way street. The actor Omar Sharif captivated a generation of French females not only with his dark good looks in Dr. Zhivago, but also by declaring he could not desire a woman who didn't love to eat. Certainly, French women, suckers though we may be for the intellectual type, could hardly care for a man indifferent to sensuality. Sensuality is vital to our ideas of seduction, and seduction figures prominently in the French woman's sense of herself. We have always known one doesn't have to be a great beauty to seduce, but one does have to be sensual. A model may catch a man's eye, but if she happens to be a sensually abstinent woman, she won't hold him for long. Style, a sense of taste and elegance can go far too, but pure arm candy is an unsatisfying supper. It's not that French women are not assaulted with as many unnatural ideals of womanhood presented in glossy magazines. We just don't take it personally. No matter how well turned out or fit, if one is not bien dans sa peau, one can never project that certain état de grâce. This is something every woman can learn to achieve, and French women channel more intuitively than most. For all her attention to what she wears and what she eats, a French woman is most defined by ease in being herself and the attractiveness of taking her pleasures. It has little to do with weighing a certain amount, and it doesn't come upon you through avoiding food. Au contraire, the meal itself, in all its splendor, has been a scene of seduction since the grand court dinners of Versailles. French women seduce with the way they order and savor food, with the sly complicity of stealing a taste from the other's plate or feeding our lover a particularly choice morsel. And just as certain formalities at the table can heighten the psychic zing of the food, so too can setting, presentation, and ambiance intensify the mood of dining together. A surprise dish or unplanned dinner out can pique the curiosity more than the loveliest